dreams of the powers and the Gibbs girls. Learning lessons, hosting parties in this modern world. Stick around, a brighter day is guaranteed. Enjoy your time and some etiquette with Emily.
Hello, and welcome to the fifth episode of Etiquette with Emily. I'm your host, Emily Pertzborn. In my last episode, I shared an excerpt from The Customs of Mankind about courtship and gift giving, advice on how to throw a Valentine's Day party from the Foodorama party book, and a part two to my Secrets of Charm series. I also shared a tip of the week from Marjorie Hillis's book, Live Alone and Like It. Today, I will share Emily Post's opinions on napkin folding, as well as a very brief history of tablecloths, the third and final part to my Secrets of Charm Lessons in Charm series, and a tip of the week from Amy Vanderbilt's 1956 edition of Everyday Etiquette. I hope you have all had a wonderful February. I can't believe spring is suddenly approaching so quickly. It feels like life is moving at a rapid speed, and I can't believe I'm already on episode 5 of this podcast. I wanted to quickly mention that I'm currently taking on new interior design clients. If you or someone you know is in need of design or decorating services, please reach out to me at hello@emilypertzborn.com. You can also visit my website, emilypertzborninteriors.com, for more info about services I provide and also to see photos of my past work. I offer in-person services in Southern California, the Dallas-Fort Worth area of Texas, and the Des Moines area of Iowa. But I also offer remote services and I'm always willing to travel for an additional fee. I also wanted to share that my Airbnb, Foxcroft Estate in Des Moines, Iowa, is booking quickly for the summer months. If you or someone you know is traveling through Des Moines, please consider Foxcroft Estate as a place to stay. We have a pool, hot tub, 4 acres of land, a tiki bar, 1970s game/TV room, a bridal suite, children's playroom, and we sleep up to 10. Please follow us on Instagram at Foxcroft Estate to stay updated and to follow along as we make updates and additions on our property. Over the past week, I've been making some overseas travel plans for summer 2024, and I'm so excited to share more about this soon. Years ago, I documented all of my travel on my YouTube channel, and I plan on doing this again this year. You can subscribe to my channel at youtube.com/@EmilyPertzborn. I will be relaunching my channel in March, so please stay tuned. All right, let's get into it, shall we? One of my favorite etiquette history books is The Rituals of Dinner by Margaret Visser. This book was published in 1991 and provides a comprehensive history of table manners. It is a great read for anyone interested in the topic. There are a couple of excerpts in the chapter titled Dinner is Served that I'd like to share with you today. The first covers Emily Post's 1920s view on napkin folding. During the 19th century, napkin folding came to be considered over-ornamental and pretentious, like crooking the little finger when holding a cup. Emily Post, in tune with the bare and functional ideals of the 1920s, pronounces that very fancy foldings are not in good taste. And she also disapproves of what had recently been the custom of folding the napkin simply and hiding the bread roll in it. She says, the bread usually fell on the floor when the napkin was lifted. Napkins should be folded square and flat, she states, and laid on top of the place plate. Never put the napkin at the side because it looks as though you are showing off the beauty of your place plate. It is very much like wearing a ring over a glove. We are talking of formal dinners, so there is no question of side plates on the table. The next excerpt I'd like to share is about the history of tablecloths. Tablecloths are first heard of in Rome at the time of the emperors. Gradually, they became essential to the beauty of a banquet, and by the High Middle Ages, they were even more expressive of the community of the diners than was the table itself. To share the cloth of a nobleman was to be seen to be treated as his equal. When a master dined with servants at the same table, either he was the only person with a cloth before him, or the whole table was covered with a cloth, but at his place, another small napkin was laid. One of the most horrible insults a medieval nobleman could endure was to be publicly humiliated and separated from his brethren by having the herald of an angry knight stride up to him at table and slit the tablecloth to the left and the right of his place, or across the top of it. Nothing but a sworn vendetta could redress honor smirched in this fashion. The host of the party must have been considerably irritated as well. Damascus in Syria was where all the best tablecloths came from. Damask was patterned with lozenges and other figures. Quite early on, purity and cleanliness won out as a most important message of the tablecloth, and it became almost invariably white. Today, damask is pure white twilled linen with only a discreet woven white pattern in it. Absolutely nothing else will do for a formal table setting. A good deal of its prestige rests upon the trouble such a tablecloth entails. It must be washed and pressed every time it is used, and a single stain ruins it. Chinese diners are said to rejoice in a messy table. The more bones, shells, pods, and crab claws litter the table, the more fun the meal has obviously been. Nothing could be further from our own ideal. By the late 17th century, the tablecloth was no longer, as it had been earlier, a space of common disorder. As the French historian Jean-Claude Bonnet puts it, it had become a pristine white space, separating out the place settings and meant to be kept as clean and clear as possible. Table linen was always a mark of wealth. Until quite recently in France, tablecloths and sheets were often handwoven and made up a substantial part of the trousseau of a well-endowed bride. They could last for generations and were handed down as heirlooms. The idea was to amass, if you could, a great deal of such linen. At late medieval banquets, splendid cloths were laid over the simple wooden boards used for tables. They were what made the setting luxurious. There were several of them, typically an under carpet first, then a large cloth covering the whole table, then two upper ones each covering the tabletop and falling to the ground of one long side. A senape, French sauvenop, or tablecloth saver, was a narrow strip of cloth lying along the table edge nearest the diners. It took most of the dirt from grubby or greasy wrists and was presumably easier than damask to wash. The senape could be made of several layers of cloth and might be used only until the washing ceremony was over. From the 16th to the 19th centuries, when meals were divided into two set courses and then dessert, two tablecloths or three were laid one above the other. One was removed after each course so that the succeeding course began with a clean cloth. Some modern restaurants have revived the practice by laying two cloths, the top one of which is removed before dessert. When a substantial lunch became a regular feature of everyday life, which it did only in the 19th century, it was a meal to which guests could be invited far less formally than they were to dinner at night. A luncheon tablecloth was allowed to be only a runner, or lacy or pierced, so that the table showed through. By this time, of course, the dining room table had become a valuable part of middle-class household furnishings, made of precious wood, polished till it gleamed, and proudly treasured. It became perfectly correct in the late 18th century to show off the table by removing all coverings for the last course, the dessert, of a formal meal, leaving only doilies, rather substantial flannel squares in place to protect the wood from being scratched by the plates. These doilies, named after the 17th century London draper called Mr. Doily, were the forerunners of our placemats. The message of these mats, apart from their function and convenience, is clear. Each person is as separate and self-sufficient as possible, given the unification represented by the table. For the past 10 years, we have found them perfectly acceptable, even for formal dinner parties. But tablecloths have recently returned to favor. For some time, these have not been always white, except on the most formal occasions. Modern washing machines and detergents have made cleanliness easier to achieve, so that we no longer require whiteness in sheets or tablecloths to make the point as strongly as possible that linen is clean. I love learning random history tidbits, and this book is filled to the brim with super specific etiquette history. Once again, the book is called The Rituals of Dinner by Margaret Visser, and it is a must-read for every fan of etiquette history. Over the last 2 weeks, I have shared tips from the 1954 book Secrets of Charm by John Robert Powers and Mary Sue Miller. You can go back to episode 3 to hear more about the history surrounding this book. Since I've been revisiting the topic of the Powers Modeling Agency, I decided to reread The Barbizon by Paulina Bren. The Barbizon covers the history of the women's-only New York hotel of the same name. The Powers Modeling Agency is just one of the many subtopics the book covers. But some other highlights of the book include Sylvia Plath's month in New York that inspired her novel, The Bell Jar, Mademoiselle Magazine's famous guest editor program, the lives of career women in 1920s through 1960s New York, and so much more. As I mentioned in my last episode when I discussed the TV shows The Gilded Age and Feud Capote vs. the Swans, I'm currently very into the social history of New York City and can't get enough on the topic. And now, here's my part 3 and last 10 lessons in charm from The Secrets of Charm. Number 1. When your eyes are fatigued, rest them as quickly as you can. You can get relief at any time by closing them and cupping your palms over the eye area so as to shut out all light. Additionally, any sparkle in your thoughts will be reflected in your eyes. Number 2. Be warned and beware of the temptation to pour on cosmetics for great occasions. As a matter of record, the overuse of makeup in the evening is the greatest single despoiler of beauty in our era. Number 3. Of all the symbols of feminine appeal, lovely hair is universally acclaimed as women's crowning glory. Shimmering locks are in themselves an unsurpassed attraction, but when they are arranged in a becoming and faultlessly groomed style, they are as a diadem upon your appearance. Number 4. Get better acquainted with your hairbrush at once. It's the best friend your hair has. And the best kind of brush to own is one with long, even, medium stiff bristles. To double the value of brushing, bend forward as far as you can and let your head dangle toward the floor. This position stimulates the flow of blood to the follicles where the hair is born, nourished, and strengthened. Number 5. Simple fare and adequate sleep contribute mightily to the normal health and growth of your hair. No amount of external care can fully efface the effect of your hair of a shoddy health regimen or a rundown physical condition. When your hair refuses to respond to proper treatment, it could be a sign that you need a physical checkup. Have one without delay. Number 6, the 10 secrets of a wondrous hairstyle are these. It must flatter you, your hair, your face, your figure, and your personality. It must dramatize the color and texture of your tresses, a feat that simplicity alone can accomplish. It must accentuate your best features. Heaven forbid that it should overlook them. It must soften your negative points and can by the twist of a curl. It must ovalize your face. Oval contours again and again are the most eye-catching. It must conform to the size of your head for the good of your figure proportions. It must complement the silhouette and clothes so that your head and dress merge in unified design. It must be easy to manage and will if professionally cut. It must groom your appearance, but cannot unless you groom it to perfection's peak. It must appeal to you, or how else can it reflect your personality? Number 7. As a solace to one's spirits, a balm to frazzled nerves, and a boom to health and beauty, nothing can take the place of a leisurely bath before dinner or before retiring. In summer, it can be a reviving cooler too when you brim the tub with warm water. To feel like a pampered darling, perfume your bath with bath crystals, meal, oil, or bubbles. Number 8. Fatigue imposes a dangerous strain on your health, appearance, and outlook. Letting yourself become overtired through work or play produces nothing but a weary expression, circled eyes, slumped posture, edgy voice, and listless or waspish attitude. If you allow your social life to interfere with your nightly rest, you should be put to bed early after a severe lecture on the value of rest to those popularity attributes, beauty and sparkle. But when it is work or mental pressure that robs you of your physical and nervous energy, you deserve the utmost sympathy and help. Number 9. Plan one day a month as your day. Schedule a minimum of chores and no social activities, meetings, studies, or good works whatsoever. Make a change of pace and occupation your sole aim. Lose yourself in some lazy pursuit that appeals to you. Read a novel, do a beauty routine, or engage in some sort of hobby. When evening arrives, you will find yourself revitalized. Number 10. Before a woman can be thought of as charming, she must cultivate fine inner qualities. The true charmer strives throughout her life to possess an open mind, a sympathetic attitude, a sense of laughter, and a generous heart. Characteristics that we of the Powers family describe as awareness, caringness, humanness, and outgivingness. And those qualities are not so easily acquired as becoming dress, graceful carriage, or poised manners. They come only to those who are deeply concerned over the well-being of others. And as a finishing thought to the series, here are the closing statements of the book. In a personal sense, it is your privilege as a woman to make yourself attractive, interesting, and of value to others. By the charm of your approach, you bring solace, enjoyment, and harmony into the lives of all who know you and happiness to yourself. More powers to you. I really do love this book so much, and I'm not quite ready to finish sharing knowledge from it. So I have saved a few full excerpts for future episodes, including how to have a more attractive voice, how to have better conversation, the keys to personal charm, and how to appraise your personality, how to be a charming bride and homemaker, and how to be an ambassador of charm while traveling. If you've been following along since episode 1, then you know I'm a recovering perfectionist, so the fact that I wasn't able to get an episode up last week was deeply upsetting for me. Moving forward, I will be sharing a mini-sode on weeks that are more difficult for me to write and record a full episode. I don't intend on sharing mini-sodes more than once per month, and I will have time in March to batch record future episodes, but with that being said, next week will be my first mini-sode. The topics I just shared from Secrets of Charm are some examples of future minisodes. They will either be in the form of a tip of the week or they will be a short history on any number of topics. Next week, my minisode topic will be the keys to personal charm and how to appraise your personality from Secrets of Charm. And now to close off this week's episode, here's a tip of the week from Amy Vanderbilt's 1956 edition of Everyday Etiquette. This book is formatted in Q&A style. Here's a question and answer about what side a man should walk on when accompanying a lady on the street. Question. My wife tells me that a man accompanying a lady on the street always walks on the curbside. Is this still true when he is walking with two ladies? Does he offer his arm? BJM, Skokie, Illinois. Answer. In America, it is customary for a man to walk on the curbside when accompanying a lady on the street, but the rule is not so hard and fast as it used to be. In Europe, the man walks on the woman's left, which may be the inside. When a man is accompanying two ladies, he may walk between them or, conservatively, on the outside, moving to the center position to assist both across the street. He does not offer his arm to a lady except to an elderly or infirm one in the daytime, although he does so at night or in bad weather. He offers his arm to a sister across the street but does not propel her by the elbow. He may never take her arm except to help her in and out of vehicles, to guide her across the street, etc. In this latter case, incidentally, a woman should bend her arm so that the man may pilot her efficiently. That concludes this week's episode of Etiquette with Emily. As previously mentioned, next week will be a tip of the week minisode about the keys to personal charm and how to appraise your personality from Secrets of Charm. Thank you so much for listening. Please rate, review, and subscribe to this podcast, as well as follow Etiquette with Emily on Instagram. Don't forget to send me your questions about anything ranging from entertaining to fashion. You can email them to hello@emilypertzborn.com or message them on Instagram. I would love to include some of these questions on the show. A huge thanks to my friend Trace for writing and performing my theme song, as well as the insanely talented Holly Holland for illustrating my logo. Once again, my name is Emily Pertzborn, and I believe it's time to put out the fire and call in the cats. Good day to you.
Etiquette with Emily.